Good afternoon. Today is Monday, March 23rd. This is the Senate Public Safety Budget Division. And we're here today to have a little discussion with the two major departments in our division. And we're not going to be taking public testimony other than the folks that we've asked to come and give us some information and answer some questions. So if you were here to talk about your program or anything like that, we're not going to be talking about that, or we're not going to be extending the conversation beyond that today. And members, for your planning purposes, we're still waiting for some fiscal notes, so we probably won't be meeting on day after tomorrow, but we'll probably meet both days next week, Monday and Wednesday. So if you've blocked off public safety for Wednesday, you've got a little time on your calendar.
Thanks.
I don't know about you, but that's a nice thing. So today we're going to ask the Commissioner of Corrections and Assistant Commissioner Cornelius first to come up and talk to us about the DOC budget. We've been given a target of 7% to hit for our division. That means approximately a $66 million reduction to the Department of Corrections, which is not a small amount. And so we asked if the commissioner could come and talk to us and give us some context and answer some questions and talk about priorities. And I see that you've brought us a lot of information by paper, so thank you for that. And I'll just turn it over to you and go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, as Senator Higgins mentioned, a 7% reduction to us is $66 million. And as I've mentioned before, I really truly believe there's no realistic or responsible way to make cuts of that magnitude without either putting our staff in imminent danger or causing risk to the citizens of Minnesota. I think we've spent many, many hours trying to come up with responsible ways to cut. And we looked all across the country at what my peers are doing in all the other states. And one of the biggest things, and we have a handout in your packet, that other states are doing is looking at releasing massive numbers of offenders early. Many are looking at implementing the sentencing guideline system and also developing local alternatives. Minnesota has done all this. And I think the first handout that you have is the one on the other states. I think I hope that's the first one. That we lock up a fraction of the number of people that other states do. And the chart that we put together here is one that shows states that are a million more than us and a million people less than us. And just looking at the chart, you can see that we rank 49th lowest in who we lock up, and you can look at the other states as well. So what and the information we've provided before, they are letting out people that are lower risk. We do not have low-level offenders that are in our system, so we do feel that early releases and are not conducive to public safety. The other considerations that we've looked at, I think they may in the short term generate some savings, but I think in the long term that some of these things will end up with more crime victims, and the return of more offenders to prison. Senator Higgins had asked us that I provide specific information regarding the cost savings and consequences of closing a prison early, early release scenarios, elimination of prison programming, reductions in pass-through funding to counties, and reductions in operation support, as well as the use of local jails. So we have that information for you today. The first part of your handout, and I know that the staff have gotten these early release scenarios. I don't know if all of the members got them, but basically the first set of them on the front and back talks about the early release of offenders and what that means in terms of prison beds saved. Also, with that, obviously, it's a reduction in staff that saves the money. So we have in there all the adjustments for severance, for laying off staff, as well as the net fiscal impact. And these scenarios we gave, as you can see here, are 90-day early release for all offenders. Then some, we were asked to provide information on sex on all offenders early release except sex offenders. The back of the page is all offenders except person offenders. Then also scenarios for 180 days also. We, again, have strong concerns about letting these offenders out early. We feel very strongly that the people that are sent to prison in Minnesota are the most serious offenders and should be sentenced according to what the sentencing guidelines say. I think that victims as well know there is what's called truth in sentencing in Minnesota, so victims know when their offender, their perpetrator will be getting out, and so this will certainly change all that. The second set of scenarios is the length of stay scenarios, and what that one does is look at right now offenders serve two-thirds of their time and are out for the last third. So that's about 67% of their time that they serve. These early release scenarios would say that the first one gives you information on how many, if they serve 50% of their time instead of 67. And obviously the net fiscal impact would be about $39 million, getting us halfway there to the $66 million. But it would also result in 527 staff being laid off. The next one is 50% of time except for sex offenders. And then the rest of them as well gives you the scenarios for 55%, 60% for the same reasons. Again, we feel strongly that this is not in the best interest of public safety. I don't think it's good policy for the state of Minnesota. I think we've got a good system and it's working. The last scenario that you ask that we provide is release violator scenarios. So they include looking at if somebody who's out on supervised release commits a violation, that they can only be, they cannot be returned for more than 90 days. And the first one is for all those release violators, and the second one shows except for sex offenders and the cost that would save as well.
Shall we ask for questions at this point? There's a lot to absorb. I've seen these before, but I don't know that other members of the committee have. Any questions at this point? Senator Foley?
Yes, Madam Chair. What I am interested in is the dealing with what might be in other states. And you have a sheet that I've looked at, which is good, but I'm not sure that it shows all of the concerns that we have in regard to Minnesota being like 49 and the jail population is about 9,000, which is paramount. What are we doing as far as any of the people that are in limited of any danger to others? It seems to me that there there's a fair amount of classifying one way or the other. Is that is there anything here that can tell me what the Pew Foundation, for instance, has been showing as far as what violators are being committed and how that affects what's going into the jails and how the cost for what you do in corrections compared to the cost of people under the correction statutes?
Commissioner, there was a lot to ask in there. So.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I'm not sure if I have all of the answers. I have seen the last Pew report, and maybe I can get a summary for you on the violations. At this point, right offhand, I don't have that information. The first Pew report, I do know that we, are the 49th lowest in cost in the nation as far as how much comes out of the general fund. That and the average is 6.7%, I think it is, for a state, and Minnesota is like 2.7%. So we're the 49th lowest in terms of what the state is spending on corrections. But I know there's a subsequent report that talked about, violations, and I don't have the summary of that with me. But I can get it for you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I was struck by the especially the 90-day early release, just a simple matter of 90 days, and how huge the fiscal impact is. Because we're up to 9,200 people or thereabouts as a population these days. Four, something like that.
The total offender population.
Yes.
9,000. It's about 9,400 right now.
And how many do we have in our probation and all of the
under supervision?
Those under supervision. Because I don't think that was on this nice chart that you gave us.
Madam Chair, it's approximately 147,000 people that are under supervision in Minnesota. And that includes both supervised release, but mostly under probation supervision.
Okay. And do you know how that compares with these other states that have population close to ours? Some don't have a supervised release program anywhere near the size of ours, I would assume.
Madam Chair, we're about the eighth highest in terms of the number of people that we have under supervision, and that's directly related to the lower number of people that are in prison.
That's what she said.
Okay. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, when you're looking at that, the comparison of costs between someone under supervised release versus someone incarcerated in one of your institutions, how does that compare?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, it's considerably less money to, have somebody on supervision. In our prison, the per diem is about $89 a day. If it's intensive supervision, I think it's about $18 a day. Yeah, it's about $18 a day for intensive supervised release. And for regular supervision, it can vary from, as low as $2 to, $10.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Foley,
obviously a considerable need to get as many people under supervision than it would be to have them locked up.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I think there's two parts to that. I think that, you know, serious offenders really need to serve some prison time, but I think that the supervised release afterward or probation of them not coming to prison is just essential. And I think all the best practices and research is showing that it's very effective as well. But especially for the ones that, you know, are on intensive supervision. I mean, those are the predatory offenders that end up on the intensive supervision. And they're the ones that commit the homicides and the sex offenses and the assaults. So I do think that there's good in having some prison time as well as the supervision.
Madam Chair, you get someone that's committed to a county jail rather than into one of your penal institutions. What kinds of violations, I guess, of parole and probation? How does that?
Senator Foley, I'm having trouble hearing you, and I suspect everybody else is too.
All right. I'm surprised that that's true, but nonetheless, I know you're correct. But, Madam Chair and Commissioner Fabian, I just want to have an idea as to how that plays out so that we know what the costs are in that area.
Commissioner, when you made these preliminary estimates, did you include the cost for supervised release or intensive supervised release? It doesn't look like it on here.
Madam Chair, no, we didn't.
Okay.
So that would be in addition to, if they got out early, you'd have to increase the county's portion of money to supervise more of them.
Okay. Senator Brooklyn?
Madam Chair and Commissioner, how does the cost of house arrest compare to the cost per day of incarceration right now in Minnesota?
House arrest would be the cost of the monitor, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, electronic monitoring is about $12 a day. And the prison is $89 a day.
Senator Berglund.
And so, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering about things like a few years ago we passed a pretty strong DUI law, and I know there were some counties at that time that were showing pretty good results with house arrest as opposed to prison or jail. And I'm just wondering if we've looked at any of those kind of alternatives. I mean, the whole reason for imprisoning somebody with a DUI is to keep them off the street, not to have them driving anymore. If they're under house arrest, we're accomplishing the same goal, I would think.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think that, you know, I haven't worked in the counties for a while, but I know that many of them still keep a lot of the felony DWIs at the local level. And I read the sentencing guidelines report, and if I remember correctly, about 70% of the felony DWIs are kept locally. And depending on the county, they are doing, you know, those kinds of things with them.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, my point isn't what the counties are doing. The point is what the state could be doing. And this is an area of growth in beds in recent years within your budget, and it would seem to me that perhaps if we don't have all the resources that we wish we had, looking at finding an alternative way to deal with the population that's caused recent growth in the budget might be something we should do.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, we do have many of the DWI offenders in the camp program, the CIP program. Part of the what we were very surprised at when they came to prison, because we had originally thought we could have them in all minimum security housing, was their prior convictions, and I think I passed out some data on that. With their prior convictions, their criminal history scores were very high, and they had considerable person offenders, weapons offenses, those types of things. So a number of them have ended up in Stillwater because of the, you know, their scores and the risk.
Senator Brewer.
Madam Chair, so how much does the $12 a day compare to the challenging incarceration program cost?
Commissioner? CIP is about 40? 49? Something like that. Somebody's searching
for
that information, we'll get that in a sec.
Well, and then, Madam Chair, I don't know, Commissioner, how much experience we have with recidivism after people leave this new prison penalty that we've created. Do you have any idea what the recidivism rate is for people leaving the Department of Corrections for DUI arrest?
Commissioner? 107. That's a per diem. Oh, the per diem for the CIP program is 107. Just to answer your.
It's more.
Prior.
It's more.
And where the savings come is because they're out considerably early, up to 2 years early.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Bergman.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, that was going to be my next point. Is that when we created this new program for incarcerating people arrested more than three times on a DUI, I don't believe that the sentence that was created was proportional to what we have for our other sentences in relationship to the severity of the crime. And so that also might be something that we should be looking at this point in time.
Senator Berglin, the bill that we'll be looking at in Senator Waugh's Judiciary Committee starting tomorrow is a compilation of policy ideas for Senator Foley's committee and mine, and there are several DWI provisions in there that you might be interested in, and that's online now for people to look at, or we can get a copy to you to look at it. One of the proposals is to have the sentencing guidelines re-rank the felony DWI. Another proposal would say it would be the fifth in 10 years rather than the fourth in 10 years for felony DWI. There have been people who have proposed to us to actually repeal felony DWI. I think that also if we could free up some money, and that doesn't seem to be like a phrase that's going to work this year, but the ream monitors or SCRAM monitors that the offenders wear when they're on house arrest or out under a judge's supervision, you know, the technology is there where they can monitor people however many times a day you want the monitor to monitor it and can tell whether there's any alcohol being put out through the sweat glands or anything like that. And I think that's a good, you know, that's good new technology. South Dakota now has a big program where they're having people be tested twice a day. And if they test positive, police officer just goes and picks them up and sends them directly to jail. And so other states are looking at felony DWI a lot, and we should be too. And I totally agree with you.
Well, Madam Chair, the only reason I raise this is not to preview what's going on in the Judiciary Committee, because I'm not even aware of that. But every time people get up in front of this committee and talk about how we can't, I just find it very frustrating because I believe there are places and ways to look at this differently and to be more creative and as effective.
And we've gotten some good information, I think, to try to do that. In the bill that we'll be having here, I hope we can come up with that because $66 million isn't a whole lot in your Health and Human Services budget, but it's a big, big chunk in ours. And so we're going to be looking for all of those kinds of things. Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just a comment about the felony DWI arrest. I can only assume that that was put in place by legislators that were obviously concerned about the death rate that was going on in the state of Minnesota. I think I'd be accurate in saying that. And we should probably be somewhat cautioned or should be cautioned about letting folks like that out of jail when we have property criminals that are locked up. Property criminals aren't killing anybody. Drunk drivers are. But I will just ask this. Did you include In your $11 figure for the house arrest, does that include the monitoring and actually going out and responding to the person? I mean, or is that just what it costs per day to wear it?
It's the equipment.
It's just the equipment.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's just the equipment.
Just follow up on that. So can we, I see Mr. Mears is here. Maybe you can give us an idea what it would cost to monitor. Oh, let's just pull a figure out of the sky. I don't know how many we have in there for felony DWIs that some would suggest.
600 and some?
Yeah, maybe half of that. Say 300 of them were to go home. What would that cost to monitor?
Mr. Mears.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't have any exact numbers, but as the Commissioner stated, that $12 to $16 a day would just be for the equipment and for the reporting where the people that we have under contract to provide that equipment. Once they get a violation, they would contact the probation officer. The probation officer, supervised release officer, then would have an obligation to go out and check on that violation. That would also entail probably some law enforcement costs also, because the agent may request the assistance of law enforcement to go out and check, or in some areas it may be law enforcement that gets called to go and check also. So there certainly are additional costs beyond just what the equipment would cost.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And of course, that isn't going to include now that all of a sudden that kicks into the judiciary system again. Now we got to go through the whole process, and we know how bogged down that is. So it's going to be pretty hard to come up with a cost of what it would actually be for individual. We're not talking $11 a head here. We're talking quite a few more dollars than that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Commissioner, that made me think of one more thing. You stated the per diem at $89 a day. And I know we have several per diems. I see on the one of the scenarios that you gave us, the bed costs are based on $52 a day. And can you talk to us about those different per diems? And I think when we try to put a fiscal savings together, I don't think we even get to save that much, do we? Talk to us about those. I think there are three different per diems. Ms. Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. There are three different per diems. We have an operational per diem, which is the average cost to house an offender in one of our systems and includes the cost for the prisons. And it's averaged over all of the facilities, and that's the $89 and however many cents. We have a marginal per diem, which is the marginal cost to bring beds into our system. Bringing beds on, for example, this next biennium will mostly be at the Faribault facility, and which is cheaper than perhaps maybe renting beds. So it's a marginal cost, and we take into consideration any new beds being added to the system over the biennium. And it's averaged over the number of offenders that will be coming in. Actually, that's probably the most complicated of all of our per diems, and we meet with your fiscal analyst every year to review all of that. So that is a number that's approved by finance. That is a number that is used for our base population forecast, and it's also used for all of our fiscal notes. So whether it be a bed increase or a decrease, that marginal per diem is the cost that we've been approved to use for fiscal notes. Then the third per diem is the statutory per diem, which includes all of the operational costs I discussed when I first began speaking. It includes capital expenditures. It includes 65% of the operations support unit within central office in the facilities.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions on anything we've heard so far? Okay, go ahead. Continue with your presentation, please.
One of the other areas that specific information was asked for was the programming within the facilities. And so that's under it's your handout that says correctional facility programming. And it really talks about sex offender programming is we spend about $5 million a year on that. and there are 29 FTEs involved in providing that. And one of the, I think, the real important things about that is we've done research on offenders that have gone through treatment and those that haven't, and our outcomes show that recidivism is reduced by 27% if they go through treatment. The chemical dependency program, if we eliminated that, that would be $9.3 million, 95 staff. Again, our outcome data shows that chemical dependency treatment reduces recidivism by 15%. Then the other programming that we have in the prison is education, and to eliminate that, it would be $8.7 million, 51 FTEs. And I think an important thing to notice, 40% of offenders come into prison without a GED or high school diploma, and 70% leave with one. Research that's been done not only by us but by the federal, some legislation at the national level, education programming reduces recidivism by 29%. And probably the biggest problem with reducing that is having idleness in the prison. If offenders don't have something to do, that studies show all over the country that there's many more incidents in prison. We're ones that for many, many years have had this programming. Others, even in this time of financial crisis, are starting to do it because they know that it cuts down on assaults. And, you know, obviously when these guys have nothing to do, it's not good. So while this amount of money doesn't come anywhere near the 7%, we also would have to add some additional personnel to help watch these individuals if they're not busy doing these productive things.
Commissioner, I think that one day when we were discussing various programming, you said about 20% of the, I think it was the sex offenders, actually got treatment. Is that number about accurate for chemical dependency program and the GED or other life skills?
Ma'am, do you have your fact sheet? Yeah. I had a sheet here that had all these facts on, but I think Nan would be a good one to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Senator Higgins, can you repeat your question, please?
I believe we've been told that the people who are eligible for sex offenders, only a sex offender programming, only about 20% actually get the treatment. Does that hold true for the CD programming as well as GED and life skills?
Madam Chair, there's a few more offenders who receive chemical dependency treatment who are directed to treatment. About 34% of those offenders who are directed to treatment for chemical dependency treatment get treatment. So we have a few more resources there.
Okay. Any questions on the programming aspect? All right, thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner.
The next area that we were asked to provide information on was the pass-through money to the counties. Currently, the counties receive $71 million a year or $143 million in pass-through funding. A 7% cut is $7.7 million a year. I provided you with the list of the different programs or the different grants that are given out through the Department of Corrections that you obviously put the money into our budget for, and what the purpose of it is for. And again, you said that I could talk about the consequences of this. The reason why, you know, we didn't recommend the any additional pass-through money reductions was because at this point, with the 147,000 people that they're supervising, they really, this isn't enough to supplement what they need to provide the resources and the supervision for them. I think, you know, we're looking at, if you look at this, it's sex offender treatment, it's the polygraphs, it's sex offender assessments. And I think the biggest worry is the actual caseloads. And I know from my experience in the counties and best practices says that you don't supervise the low-risk offenders. So they have already put most of these on huge supervision caseloads or group supervision or on administrative caseloads. And so they basically are computerized, and if they owe restitution, you know, that's how they're supervised on that. The regular caseloads are people that are not on the intensive supervised caseloads that are the predatory offenders. So it's your level 3 sex offenders, it's the murderers, it's all of these. They only stay on it for a certain amount of time and then are transferred to regular caseloads. So the people that are on the regular caseloads, already they're at over 100 in most counties. And the regular are all your, you know, aggravated assault, all of those kinds. They do not have your low-risk people on them. So we feel very strongly that this shouldn't be cut.
Okay. Questions about this? Great. Thank you.
Okay, then the next one is the reduction in our department operating support, and we are taking a 5% reduction in that. And I know that there were some questions, and I thought that Assistant Commissioner Cornelius, so many people, so little time. That she could maybe just give you a little breakdown of what's included in that.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner Cornelius.
The Operations Support Division is staff that work in the finance area, human resources, IT, diversity, employee development, the commissioner's staff, myself, policy and legal services, which includes hearings and release and records. This division has worked very, very hard over the last 10 years to streamline all their functions. We've regionalized our financial services. We've regionalized HR. We've centralized some functions within both those units. IT has also worked to share supervisors amongst facilities. We did provide two documents breaking out staff for IT and finance, as they are the biggest units within operations support. We've done some analysis and compared to other state agencies, and we're finding we're quite lean, actually, in these areas compared to a lot of other agencies and what we provide. We also provided some detail about the level of transactions and some of the work that these units do.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to just point out on the IT handout that we gave you, the systems that we are required to keep up are on the last page, and I would look at that first. If you can see our statewide supervision system, we really keep that up for, you know, all of the counties as far as the probation. And if you look at the agencies using it, law enforcement has it available in their car, so if they're pulling over somebody that's on supervision, they know that. We show them if they're at risk, have they done anything, you know, before as far as, you know, we red flag if they've, you know, assaulted an officer or if they have priors on fleeing. So it's those kinds of things, and I think the last page really spells it out, you know, the how interrelated, you know, these systems are. And, you know, we have to have people to do these if you think that it's important to provide this. And, you know, it's like the sex offender, the level 3, you know, website. We, you know, keep that up. And it's pretty much summarized there. And I would also ask if you, I know I'm giving a lot of information here, but, you know, just looking at the what we have to do when it comes to the other functions that Lisa also provided a summary of there. You know, just the number of transactions in trying to deal with offenders. I mean, all of that is mandated. It's in statute that we have to do. And I think a 5% cut is something that we can do, but I don't think any more than that and still keep on doing all of this.
Questions? Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I was I'm looking at this list of required reports that the IT staff has to do, and it seems to me that the Minnesota statute, I suppose, there are an awful lot of federal reports that are part of this. Is this as a result of money that we've taken from the feds, and now we're kind of obligated to report to them, or is that how did they get us to? What's the hook for us to do this?
Assistant Commissioner Cornelius?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, some of them are because of federal grant dollars we receive, and some of them are for other reasons, and I'm not sure. Deb, do you know?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, many of these
Could
mandated...
You identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Deb Kirshner. I'm with the Department of Corrections, Information, and Technology. Many of the mandated reports are just a part of compliance with federal reporting for numbers of offenders being served. They're the numbers that are used in making sure that all states are aware of how they're delivering services as compared to other states. The ones such as the Internal Revenue Service and the SCAP report, some of them may have implications for funding that come to the state, and they're also to ensure compliance with federal laws as to whether or not offenders under our jurisdiction are appropriately reporting or not reporting their income. I don't know if that answers your question, but they are at this point mandated for us to reply to.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kirshner, how onerous are these reporting requirements? Like hours, or do we have a system in place now that it's not given computers and such? I guess I'm trying to get a sense from you on what level of work it takes to do these reports.
Madam Chair, Senator, some of the reports are indeed not onerous. Most of them are annual or semi-annual, and with the advent of the computerization that our IT staff support, we're typically able to comply to them anywhere between one day to one week or two. Some of the more difficult ones include the ones for the Internal Revenue Service, but again, with the computer systems that we've developed and been able to support, we can typically use one staff person to do them within, a week or less.
The one I think that stands out as the strangest one is the state prison match for drug offenses required by the Federal Aviation Administration. And that seems to be a very odd match.
Madam Chair, interestingly enough, that one is an attempt by the federal government to ensure that pilots are complying with reporting any convictions or incarcerations related to drug offenses. And I'm not sure all of the details of how they use our data to ensure that, but they do require that we report to them on that particular usage.
Interesting.
Madam Chair,
Senator
one more
Hall.
Question. Commissioner or Ms. Kirshner, I'm looking at all the research and program evaluation that the IT staff engages in. And I mean, we're looking at things like institutional community work crew evaluation, education program evaluation, treatment studies, main core evaluations, accountability evaluations. And I know that we foist a lot of these tasks onto you, but I have increasingly becoming more concerned about the real capacity or the appropriateness of us asking department staff to conduct these type of research or evaluations when, in fact, it might not be within their capacity to do this. Have you given any thought to this, and would you have any feedback or recommendations as to how we can do this differently?
Madam Chair, Senator, the list you see before you is currently within the capacity of the staff that we have now. What we have found helpful, not only in our unit but as a department, are to truly do true evaluation and not just report back to you but also to our managers that we've had this many offenders doing this many program entries, but to follow them up and control for factors like other programming, past history, county of commitment, race, gender, age, and those kind of things to truly make sure that the programs that we offer in the institutions and in the field are making a difference in the lives of the offenders when we release them. And these kinds of research and evaluation projects that we're doing are providing us and you all with that information. We're very careful. We have a submission process for any that are internally generated to make sure that they are in keeping with the resources that we have. And so we have them on a schedule so that we're not trying to overburden staff.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
One follow-up question. So when you hire your IT staff and your staff for these positions, do you require that they have research or evaluation background in doing this work?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's one of the sort of strange consequences of the way we're organized. If you'll look on the front page of this handout, you'll notice that down under central office, we have six staff, 6.5, and I'm actually considered in one of those 6.5 right now, who are totally dedicated to research, evaluation, handling the public data requests, handling the mandatory reporting. So their criteria or their qualifications aren't your typical IT. So you would, if you were looking at true IT staff, you would actually subtract those 6.5 from the 63 at the bottom, and they are truly hired as researchers or data analysts. And so they do have those qualifications. In fact, our supervisor in that area has a PhD in criminology. So we are looking for researchers, people with experience and expertise in data analysis.
Thank you.
Great. And I just looked at the clock, and it occurs to me I should probably move the discussion along a little. So, Commissioner, anything else to talk to us about?
You know, I think the last thing that I provided, you had asked for the number of beds that we're using at jails, at local jails. So we have contracts with the county jails that are listed there. We have some others that we're negotiating with as well.
These are separate from the short-term offender contracts?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And members, this was brought about by an article that was on public radio just a week or 10 days ago about the couple of the counties complaining that their jails were empty. And what a terrible thing that was. So that's good information from us, too.
Madam Chair, just one last thing on that. We have been, in using this, we've been for violators, release violators. That's what we, majority,
what
are using this for, and it's been working out very well.
And I noticed that Hennepin isn't one of those. Is Hennepin's facility usually too full to put the release violators there?
Yes, Madam Chair. Any
other questions for DOC at this point?
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
Did the commissioner already talk about this chart?
We started with
seen
that
a couple
one.
Of times. Commissioner, I've talked to you about this before, and I keep coming back to this list. And I think I asked you this once before that, I know we're very proud that we're 49th in our incarceration rate, but in terms of the total people who are incarcerated as well as the people who are in community corrections, is there ever a ranking for that? So the total number of people in a state that's part of incarcerated and in community corrections, where will we rank?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't think they do it that way. I mean, they do it in terms of how many are under supervision. So, and we're ranked 8th, so that's very high. And then we're ranked very low for the numbers that are in prison, but they don't combine the scores.
Mm. Okay. Okay, Commissioner, thank you. Ms. Cornelius, thank you. As we go forward and put this budget together, I know that we'll be asking you lots of questions. And let me say publicly in advance how much we appreciate all the information that you put together for us. We're all in this boat together, and we'll be asking more about priorities and other information as we go along and try and figure out our $66 million cut.
Thank you
very much. For DOC, for Department of Public Safety, I think we have Assistant Commissioner Ellison. Is that right? If I could find my agenda. I'm right. Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. I have only a couple of handouts, Madam Chair, and I know one of them you really don't like, and that is the 7% chart. And we also, you had asked me about cars, and so I did do a handout on cars. The reason I did the 7% is that it'll relate to some of the testimony that I will give you today.
Okay.
First of all, just let me say I really appreciate the difficulty, and we all do at Public Safety, of the task that you have before you. It is not an easy task. And we understand that some very difficult choices will need to be made. When we look at a 7% cut to the general fund in the Department of Public Safety, first of all, I think we have to understand the context of our budget. Only 29% of the total Department of Public Safety budget comes from the general fund. So then when we look at that 28% that comes from the general fund, 80-plus percent of the general fund dollars within the Department of Public Safety are either in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension or the Office of Justice programs. So really, when we're talking about a cut to public safety, we're talking about a cut mainly to those two areas of our agency. So those are the areas that I'll focus on and provide some different scenarios that you requested. You also asked about Homeland Security and Emergency Management. A 7% cut to HSEM would amount to just under $176,000. What that would equate to is the elimination of three hazardous materials response teams. We have a total of 11 in the state, and that would mean a reduction of three. And obviously no decision, we don't have any recommendation as to where they would be eliminated or anything like that, but that really equates to elimination of three out of the 11 hazardous materials response teams. Within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, a 7% cut would be $2,934,050, just under $3 million. I just wanted to remind the committee that last year the integration efforts were cut a total of $1.265 million per year, and that cut continues into the 10 and 11 biennium. So that cut was made, and so we need to factor that in as we look to the future. Also, there was $250,000 that was a general operating cut to the BCA. The language for that cut indicated that we could not take that from forensic science laboratories, so that was taken from investigation. So I just wanted to, just as context, point those two areas out that have been reduced. Really, when we're talking about a cut of this magnitude within the BCA, we're talking about elimination of some pretty substantial programs or really talking about some substantial cuts. And of course, we understand this is a difficult time and the committee has to set priorities. And we will work with you to give you the best information we can about what the impact of the different cuts that might be proposed would be. Minnesota Justice Information System, now has a $700,000 a base budget for integration efforts. The Criminal Justice Policy Oversight Group and the task force, which is made up of people from throughout the criminal justice system, identified three of those integration efforts as being their top priorities: e-charging, name event index, and cybers, comprehensive incident-based reporting system. Basically, a cut to that program would mean further delays in those integration efforts. And There's just no way around it. I mean, if we cut the money, then we won't be able to implement the projects as quickly.
I got two of them. I didn't get the middle one. E-charging, cybers, and
name event index.
Okay, thank you.
Obviously, if we reduce the forensic science lab budget, turnaround time is definitely affected. One of the concerns that people have with the DNA evidence and such is that they like a quick turnaround time. We've been trying to improve our turnaround time. Obviously, we do every effort to be as accurate also as we can. And That reduces the service that we're able to provide in a quick manner to the criminal justice system. We have a BCA lab in Bemidji area. We certainly could, even though this isn't something that would be tenable to a lot of people, but we could close the Bemidji lab and move all of those staff down to the Twin Cities, to our St. Paul lab, and that would result in a budget reduction of $920,000 per year. The people in the northern area really value that lab and use it and would not be happy about that at all, but that would be a $920,000 reduction. Another area that obviously is quite untenable, but you asked for a different scenario, so I certainly will put them out, is if we stopped registering sex offenders, that would save $1.6 million per year. Now, again, that's not going to be very tenable to many people, but that is a budget item that is rather substantial. Another area within the BCA is the training function. We are mandated by law to provide training to law enforcement officers throughout the state. If we stop doing all of our training, that would reduce the budget by $550,000 per year.
On that note, is there someplace else that people could get that training?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, police officers are able to go to community colleges and other entities to get training. People rate the training that the BCA provides very highly and feel like it's a very much a bargain compared to what they have to spend, obtaining the training in other places. But the BCA is not the only entity in the state of Minnesota that provides training.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be basically then looking at eliminating that would be another county, I hate to say the word mandate, but I mean that would, county and cities would have to take that whole thing. And do you have any idea what kind of an increase that would be then, being it's $550,000 now? What would local counties and cities approximately have to pay if they went to the local community colleges?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, through the POST Board, would be able to give you a better indication of that than I would be able to, but through the POST Board, each city is provided an allowance for each police officer that they have for training. So each officer is assigned a certain number of dollars to be used for training each year. I don't know currently exactly how that's used, if that is folded into their general fund budgets or if it's actually designated for training, but there is that source of funding, and I think, again, the POST Board could probably give you more details than I could today.
Want to check on that and report back to us? Okay, great. Commissioner?
Currently, we have 62 agents located throughout the state that provide assistance to locals. And if you had local sheriffs and police chiefs here, they would undoubtedly talk about the valuable service that is provided in those complicated cases that, is particularly in rural areas, they don't get very often. But the cost per agent, when you consider salary and benefits and assigning someone a car and all of that, is about $109,000 a year. So if you wanted to cut some agents, you could multiply the number of agents. That would be reduced times $109,000, and that would give you a reduction there. Madam Chair, that gives you some scenarios for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Okay.
The next largest area is the Office of Justice Programs.
Okay, hold on just a second. Senator Foley had a question.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, looking at your lab service, for instance, we have had an indication when we built the BCA office and facilities there that you would have a state-of-the-art lab, forensic lab, and then be able to serve the various police agencies in the state of Minnesota. And I'm wondering is, because I've seen all of this cost that we've had to fund local laboratories. Well, Hennepin has one, and Minneapolis has one, and St. Paul, and Anoka now is in the process of building that. I'm just curious to know why the locals are forced to do that, if you will.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I think what is being experienced at the local level is a frustration with with the fact that the BCA has many, many cases, serves the whole state, and they want a particular process for their cases, and they want the process to be increased. We certainly would be able to take many more scientists at the BCA. If we that facility was created to handle many, many more scientists than we currently have employed there, and if we had a full complement, I think that, my opinion would be that that would reduce the need for local labs. But again, I think the reason that local governments are coming in is because they want more attention paid to their particular cases, and the BCA has a limited number of scientists.
Commissioner, I think we have budgeted 14 new scientists in the last budget that we did, and those are all hired and working now. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, many of them have been hired. A couple of things have happened since we got the increase in 15. One of the things that's happening as a result of local labs being constructed and scientists being hired is that it takes about 9 months to a year before a forensic science laboratory person that we hire is really up to speed and even able to operate alone. What happens because of the disparity in salaries between what the local governments are able to pay and what state agencies are able to pay, some of the local labs have been able to hire our scientists away from us after we have invested the time in training them. So we've had some people leave that we have trained, which has reduced our complement. So what we did was we had a salary, a Hay study completed by the Minnesota Management and Budget Office that looked at comparing the forensic scientist salaries to other areas of where scientists are employed, and as a result, we raised our salaries several steps, and so we weren't able to purchase as many forensic scientists as we thought we would have under the lower salary structure. So I believe we've hired about 8 of the 15 scientists that were allotted to us at this time.
I think the mayor of Minneapolis, in his revised budget after our last budget go-around, so in the last month or so, has recommended closing their crime lab because it's a duplicate of state services. So if they do that, you'll end up with even more scientists that you could possibly look at. And more work to do as well.
Madam Chair, that's the concern, though, is that, number one, we want to have highly qualified agents and technicians, and I just think that we're going to have to be very careful that we don't get people that are laid off or transferred to a job that pays more money than we paid for. I guess what I'm saying is that we don't want to spend or do that where we're going to lose and have empty buildings.
So, Commissioner, your two priorities for the BCA budget are the forensic scientists in the lab and MNJIS. Would I be correct in that statement?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, everything that we do at the BCA is a high priority for one or more of our constituents.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
What I was pointing out is just you had asked that we really put some things on the table that, you know, if we did this, here's the consequence. And so that's what I was That's what I was doing. And again, as we proceed with budget talks, I mean, I'm laying out today some different alternatives, and obviously we want to take into account what the committee's priorities are. And if you have particular priorities and things that you want us to consider, we would lay out those scenarios for you.
Okay, good. Senator Ma?
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, with respect to MNJIS, are there federal dollars involved here that if we somehow couldn't get CYBRS or the e-charging or the system up this year, that are we losing opportunities for funding from elsewhere?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, I'm going to ask Superintendent O'Malley to answer that question.
We're hiding back behind the pole. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. Madam Chair and Senators, I don't know the specific amount of federal money. I know that we have leveraged a fair amount of federal money in that, and we continue to do that. I do know that we have applied for as much as we can get, and there's nothing on the horizon that we can see right now that would supplant or backfill or help us in the event that there were some reductions in the MNJIS more than the 1.265 that was already mentioned.
Well, Madam Chair, my question was that what if we can't go forward with some of these things? Are we are we committed to going forward on a grant, so we have to go forward, or can we delay these projects? If we have to balance multiple competing things, and if we made the decision to say maybe this is the least, you know, worst case scenario, if this is the least palatable of all of them, is it are we going to be fundamentally harmed in some way with other potential funding sources, I guess?
Superintendent O'Malley?
Madam Chair, members, I can find out the matching dollars, if that's what you're talking about, that if in the event that we reduce this now, are there some grants out there that we would then lose? I don't believe there are.
Okay.
I think if we reduce this by any amount, it would just slow those down.
Right. Okay.
But I will find that out and let you know.
Well, and Madam Chair, the reason I ask that is that, you know, for something that's within our control, slowing it down so that we can keep some other things on the road is, for me, the way we balance it. So I really appreciate your candidness. It's not that we don't want to do those things, but we're trying to see how we can tweak with the numbers. And I appreciate your candidness in that.
Great. Madam Chair, members, to clarify, when I say slow down, it's you know, the 1.265 slowed it down. We went from a certain level of pilot projects to another level. And there's been probably close to $3 million invested in those top three priorities, the cybers, NICE, and e-charging. And we're down now to very small one- or two-county pilot projects. So it's creeping right now, just to be clear.
Another bad thing we can blame on the economy. Okay, thank you. And then Commissioner Ellison, I think you were going to start on OJP before I interrupted you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, within the Office of Justice Programs, we are going into the next biennium with approximately $963,000 per year less than the previous years. We are fortunate in the Office of Justice Program to be eligible for the one-time stimulus funds that the federal government is providing. Certainly that doesn't solve the problem indefinitely, but it certainly is a help that other agencies don't have. So that's a consideration. When we look within the Office of Justice Programs and what we are doing, one of the big ticket items is Battered Women's Shelter Services, and that's $19 million per year. The problem with cutting that right now is that shelter beds are full, and shelter beds are full over a longer period of time than they used to be, basically because of a lack of affordable housing for low-income people. So, again, we certainly can look at the locals picking up more of those costs, but it is just something to consider that right now bed days are really hard to come by in the shelters. Crime victim assistance grants, that totals $4.6 million a year to general crime, sexual assault, and battered women's programs throughout the state. Each program gets an on average $50,000 per year. So again, if you were looking at cutting some programs throughout the state, the total that you would save per program would be about $50,000 per year. One of the things that we've implemented in the last few years is the Victim Information Notification System Every Day program. That's a program that provides automatic computerized notification or a call center notification to crime victims when the custody status of the offenders that committed the crime against them are reduced or they're let out of custody. We were able to technologically advance that so that local units of government police officers don't have to make those calls. That program is $455,000 a year. Obviously, it would be detrimental to stop that because local police and sheriff's offices really like not having that burden of notification, but that is an area that was recently added to our service components. A law enforcement and community grants total $9,488,000 per year. Again, I think if the committee decides that because we're having such a hard time with the economy being what it is, more of those programs need to be, more of the law enforcement programs need to be picked up by local police agencies. That certainly is one scenario. Something that would be very painful, I think, to all of us, but certainly is an option for the committee to consider is that we simply get out of the prevention business and stop funding any sort of community prevention programs. That would be about $3 million per year. Again, I'm not recommending these things. I'm
Absolutely.
Saying these are the honest to goodness scenarios that, the committee has to struggle with. And again, because of the one-time federal stimulus dollars, we were able to blunt some of that pain, but it doesn't solve the problem long-term. So with that, I would take any questions.
Are there organizations that we have funded in our bill before that would be eligible for OJP? We talked about this a little bit in one of the last committees. For OJP funding from the stimulus funds that...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. There are programs that have received funding through the state that would and are eligible for the stimulus funding.
This is kind of a strange idea, but could, like, the gang and drug task force or the, you know, the other task forces that we do, the financial crimes task force, could those be funded through OJP funds?
Madam Chair, yes.
Stimulus funds?
Yes.
Then clearly we wouldn't do the maximum amount. I forget who. Ms. Boisvert was saying that she was thinking of doing a maximum of like $300,000 for each grantee. You know, 50 to 300,000 was kind of the range she was looking at.
Madam Chair, that could be. I'm not.
Okay.
Is that she's nodding right? Her head. Yes.
Okay. And I guess I can look up somewhere how much those various task forces are line items in our budget. But so that would be one kind of unexpected place we could get some money to move things around.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I think the thing that you just want to avoid is supplant. I mean, these, you know, the federal government does say that we can't out and out supplant, but those, all of those entities that you mentioned are eligible to apply for the stimulus funding.
Okay. Questions? Senator Foley? You look like you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm curious about is the alcohol and gambling part of that. What is that all funded by the lottery, or what happens to other people in the pull tabs and those kinds of things?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I didn't talk specifically about the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division because their general fund allocation is smaller than the other two agencies, or the three agencies that I mentioned, and their cut would be $117,950. And, you know, they would have to make that up, and certainly it would have an impact on alcohol and gambling enforcement if we were to reduce that budget.
I think there is a reduction in the governor's budget pages. From
that was a shift.
That was a shift.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of a reduction.
Okay.
No reduction.
And no reduction. Mr. Turner says I'm wrong. Okay. It was something I dreamed of. I've been reading a lot of bizarre books lately. I'm sure that was
your reading.
Okay. Any other questions? Anything else you'd like to give us some advice on?
Madam Chair, no, but just as I said before, we certainly stand ready to provide you with any information that you need as you consider these decisions.
Have you talked at all about, you know, I think other states or even some of our local governments are talking about furloughs, you know, requiring that employees take a certain number of days off without pay. Have you had any kind of discussions about that kind of thing? Is that even allowed for in our negotiated agreements with our unions?
Madam Chair, that would be something that the Office of Minnesota Management and Budget would have to lay out for us.
Okay.
as state agencies. And I'm not sure if they've considered that as part of the budget solution or not. I just don't have that information.
I know I'd rather have a couple of days off than lose my job totally, but...
Madam Chair, I think it's clear that that's a bargaining thing that would require a process through what used to be DOOR, and so I don't think that we're going to get any money there.
Yeah, probably not. Commissioner, are there, you talked about the training that we do that could conceivably be done at community colleges and those kinds of things. Are there other trainings or even exercises and activities that you fund that could be either postponed or eliminated or done by some other entity? Was training mostly the one that kind of struck you?
Madam Chair, we do a significant amount of training in Homeland Security Emergency Management, but my recollection is those are funded with federal dollars. And we do some training within the Office of Crime Victim Services. Certainly that's an area we look at. It's a very small portion of the budget, so eliminating that wouldn't save a whole lot of money. And if we are looking at reducing the amount of programs, then we certainly would want to provide support services to the programs that are remaining and help them deliver the best possible services that they could. So those are the areas that quickly come to mind.
Okay. And speaking of Homeland Security, I think I heard someplace that the Emergency Operations Center is up.
Madam Chair,
the floods?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, it is up. Director Idy is up in the northwestern part of the state right now. We're expecting flooding, and the latest weather reports indicate that this flooding could, in fact, be severe. 1997 levels or worse.
Or worse, yeah. I think Senator Stumpf told us that the road to his farm is underwater at this point. So, are the other, the more local EOCs opening up as well? Like, I know Ramsey, Hennepin, Minneapolis, St. Paul all have EOCs. And I know they do a lot of work back and forth. Are they concentrating mostly at the state EOC, or are they the others opening up as necessary?
Madam Chair, the operation centers in the counties that are affected are fully operational. The Salvation Army is there. Sandbagging is occurring. Meals are being provided for the people that are doing the sandbagging. We are responding to calls for assistance so that they're not able to do certain things at the local level. We can move equipment. We're sending this state patrol contingency there. So everything, and our Homeland Security Emergency Management Office is coordinating all of the activities of all the different state agencies. They've been meeting on a regular basis. They met over the weekend. So everybody's getting lined up to provide the services that will be needed.
Great, great. It's a good resource for the local governments to have. They have somebody who knows who to call to help. And I'm glad we have that. Process. Well, thank you. I don't see anybody else with any other questions. I appreciate all the information you've given us, and I'm sure you'll get lots of panicked phone calls and emails from me in the future. So thank you all, everyone. You're adjourned.